Hello and welcome to episode 53 of Good Copy, Bad Copy. I'm Emily King, Radix's content marketing manager, and I'm joined by Fiona Campbell-House, founder and lead copywriter at Radix Communications.
Hello.
And I'm also joined by Radix's creative director, David Maguire.
Hello.
Okay, so this episode, it's kind of last year, was it last year or the year before last? One of our contacts at Content Marketing Institute was like, you guys, you got some inconsistent styling going on your blog. And we had to start coming up with our own style guide. And eventually, because, you know, summer, it finally happened. It became a thing. This might be because I read a certain other style guide, which we'll be mentioning heavily later in this podcast. But
intriguing.
Yeah. It's not going to be a big secret once it's revealed. It's not like the best. Well, we'll find out how good it is. In this episode, we are discussing obviously style guides in business-to-business copywriting and marketing. And of course, what do we actually mean when we say style guide? And how do you use them? And how do you even choose or write one in the first place? I'm hoping to, you know, with this episode, stop people from thinking they need style guides that are as long as Ulysses. I mean, I've seen some equivalents that perhaps are a little excessive in terms of internal style guides.
You don't mean the cartoon Ulysses 31?
If they were as good as that, that'd be fine. But I'm thinking more of the original, you know, story. As ever, if you have any questions or comments about this episode, please feel free to email us via podcasts@radix-communications.com, or you could tweet us at radix.com. So, David, Fiona, I think there's one thing we need to clear up first. What is the difference between an editorial style guide and a voice and tone guide?
Oh, I thought you were going to ask what the name was of the little red robot in Ulysses.
Yes.
I think. I don't know. Yeah. Maybe people could tweet us and tell us.
I have it on box set. I actually had the box set of it because I used to watch it when I was very little.
Sorry, off on a tangent, but do tweet us if you know. Sorry, Fiona.
Oh, but I have to answer the question.
Either of you, someday.
So I have to say, when I first saw this question, I panicked. I thought, do I know the difference between an editorial style guide and a voice and tone guide? But actually, there is quite a big difference, I think, between the two, although they both should form part of an even wider document, which is your general brand guidelines, which includes not just writing guidelines, but guidelines for design and branding. And even sometimes, you know, if you've got customers talking to people, how your customers should talk to people. And so the voice and tone element of that is really guidance on how to use words to convey the personality of the brand. And not just the personality of the brand in one situation, which would be your overall voice, but the personality of the brand in different scenarios in which you're communicating with people. And that is where you vary the tone of what you're saying. So I guess voice and tone guide is all about the brand personality, whereas your editorial style guide is the kind of 230-page document that you've just referred to, which is all the nuts and bolts of how you write for that brand, but the technical way you write for it. So, you know, how to use naming conventions, you know, what is the correct terminology to use? How do you format bullet points? When do you use M-dash? When do you use N-dash? That would be in the editorial style guide, as far as I'm concerned, unless, David, do you have any other views?
No, that's a very, very good summary of what I had, really. You know, as you say, the voice and tone is about your brand's kind of character in different contexts, whereas the editorial style guide can be an expression of that in a way, where, you know, if your brand's personality is particularly traditional, you might reflect that in some of your style choices. And the thing about the reason that you need a style guide is it's not just a case of, you know, grammatically, is this right or wrong? It's, you know, where you have choices in matters of style around, as you say, dashes or SI units or capitalization or compass points or something. So it can be an expression of the voice or the character that you're aiming for, but equally, you know, where, for example, you'd look at a style guide that where you want consistency across multiple writers, there's scope for a variety of voices, a variety of tones, all using the same style guide as you maybe find in a publication. You know, you might have very many distinct writers and with all their own voices, but you'd like them all to punctuate a quotation the same way.
Yeah, and that's really the important thing about them, isn't it? It's when you've got multiple people writing for your brand. It's how do you keep all of those people consistent, which is hard enough even when they're all writing in English. And, you know, there's lots to be said around, you know, varying the style guide and the voice and tone between even UK and US English. But, you know, some of the brands that we write for are writing across all different markets in all different languages. And it's how do you keep that consistent across all of that diversity? And that's where documents like these come in really useful.
Okay, so as I was kind of hinting at, we've just started putting together, have kind of, there's a working document, people can refer to it now, our own style guide for our own content, that, you know, what you read on the blog or what you might see in our emails and even some of our social media. And it's based on the Economist style guide. But also, when our clients don't have a style guide in place, we refer back to the Economist style guide ourselves. And this has been a long-running tradition. This has been the way of things since I joined Radix, and I assume from before. So Fiona, why did you decide that the Economist style guide would be our default guide for external work? And obviously I'm happy to use it for internal work as well, but why did you decide on it in the first place?
I don't think there's a really deep answer to this. But, you know, there is always, there's the need to fall back on something. There's a need for a default style guide if the client hasn't got one. We quite often work with clients where they haven't got their own style guide. And you need something to, you know, we have a team of writers here, so you need something to ensure consistency across the writing team here. I happen to love The Economist itself. I read it every week. I like the quality of the writing, the style of the writing that's in it. I had worked at previous places where we used the Economist style guide as our default if the client didn't have one, so we just went with that. I will say that we default to that for UK English, and for US English, we default to the AP style guide. Or we should. But I think these days, I mean, most of the clients that we're writing for these days, most of the brands we're writing for, fairly big tech brands, they've got their own style guides that we work from. So we don't have to fall back on either of these very often.
I mean, I suppose I should sort of say something for continuing to use the Economist style guide for our content. And I read through it. I read through everything bar the reference bits at the back, you know, where they kind of, there's lists and numbers and things. And I kind of stopped at that point, but I read the first two parts recently in the 11th edition and made extensive notes, and including bits I didn't agree with, and including bits I did agree with that I needed to point out to our writers. And that one thing that I particularly agree with them for usage was the use of double quotation marks, mm-hmm. And then using single quotation marks if it's a quote within a quote, or, you know, a quote within speech. And I know that certainly at school level, everyone gets taught here, in, at least in England, to use single quotation marks for speech.
I didn't.
Yeah. That's what happened when I was going through the education system. They preferred us to use single quotation marks.
Maybe that's a millennial thing.
It might be, because everyone else in the office, when they write blog posts for us, at least previously, now they need to be following the new style guide, was using single quotation marks in our own blogs, or sometimes mixing up with double because they, you know, been going between client work and writing for our blog. But I could trace it back to being taught to write with single quotation marks and various bits of sort of like where the punctuation would be going in or out of the sort of single quotation marks as well.
Well, I didn't go to school in England. That's my excuse.
But yeah, so it was nice to kind of be able to refer back to the Economist style guide and go, ah, I like this. I like the way of doing it. And it looks clearer to me when you're certainly in sort of like digital copy and stuff, to kind of like, it's a problem with a single quotation mark. It's like it's just a single little mark, and it just, it floats there, and if it's on the right-hand side of something, it looks like it could be an apostrophe, I feel like it can be easy to miss, which is really annoying when people are like, obviously, like scanning text and stuff, and it offers context, and you don't want people to miss out on the context of what they've just read.
What did you not like about the Economist style guide?
I felt their attitude towards gender neutrality was a bit lackluster and a bit too old school, even though this, the 11th edition was printed last year. They had issues with they, theirs, and there, and I was just kind of like, no, we can, it sounds fine in the prop, you know, in a good context, like we can use this. So that was one thing. I also didn't agree with putting double quotation marks around titles, because I'm a humanities graduate at the end of the day, and since I was English with media studies, and we used MHRA style guide for bibliographies and quoting and stuff. So it's just kind of like, no, we'll use italics. Italics is fine. We don't need to then clutter the space up with more quotation marks if there's also quotes in this, as well as the titles of books and films or websites or, you know, anything other media products, basically.
Well, so I agree with you on both of those points.
Yeah, and so we'll default to the Economist Style Guide, except where we don't agree with it.
Yeah, and that's pretty much, I think it's like 5 pages currently, our little style guide that kind of is like bits to cool, sort of like we sort of like bring attention to just because our writers aren't used to it. And then bits where we're like, but except for these instances, we don't agree with the Economist Style Guide. So what does a good style guide need to have at the end of the, like, when a company is producing a style guide for themselves? And I'm sure there could be a couple of listeners who are kind of like the younger companies and they haven't got around to this important act yet. What does it need to have?
Well, you and I both wrote down the same top thing, didn't we,
yes,
for what it needs to have, and that's navigation, because these are very, well, they can be very long documents, and they kind of get added to over time. And, you know, if you're writing for a brand that has lots of its own terminology, you know, if it's a very big brand, it's got lots of different product and service areas, there's lots of terminology in each of these areas, these style guides can just get massive. And, you know, trying to track down the right word or the right way of formatting something can be really difficult if it doesn't have proper navigation in it. So the ones we tend to get tend to be PDFs with not very much, if any, navigation. But I have seen them done really nicely online, where you can just jump to the thing that you want and find what you want really quickly, which, you know, as writers, and we're always on deadline, we don't want to be kind of fishing around in a style guide for half an hour trying to find the right way to do a bullet point. So definitely navigation.
Yeah, absolutely, because they need to be quite comprehensive. And it's sometimes, it, particularly if they're, you know, linked in amongst themselves. So, you know, for this thing, see that thing. And it's hard to always know where to look for the thing that you want. So if you want to know for this particular style guide, do they capitalize compass points? Southwest is Southwest is it capital S, capital W? Are they hyphenating that? How are they, you know, or does it depend on context? Is it, you know, the Southwest is this, or do they talk about, you know, or the Southwestern something? You know, there's so many different ways of handling that. Now, do you go to S for Southwest? Do you go for C for compass points? D for directions? You know, there are many places you could look to find the same piece of information. So being able to quickly skip and go, oh, no, it's not there, it's over here. Again, that's the thing. Because if it's, as well as deadlines, if it's fiddly to find stuff, people just won't use it if it's a pain. And then people will just guess. And that's where inconsistency comes in, and then your style guide starts to be useless. It needs to be easily dippable.
Okay, obviously we've now been talking a lot about style guides, but just to bring it back to an earlier sort of discussion around voice and tone, what's a good voice and tone guide need to have to guide writers and people working within businesses?
Well, I think the thing with the you know, an editorial style guide can be really comprehensive. A voice and tone guide really needs to not be. It needs to be short. It needs to be punchy, I think. I've seen some that are so thick. And if you're giving that to someone who's writing within your organization, I mean, if you're giving it to someone that's writing all the time, or they're a professional writer, professional copywriter, then fine, they've probably got the time to invest in getting their head around this thing. If it's something you're circulating internally and you want people to actually pay attention to it, certainly the tone and voice guides that we produce for clients aim to be very short, very practical, no more than just a few pages to get your head around what you're trying to achieve. So I think that sort of convenience is key. I think it's also important that that they're written in the target voice that you're aiming for, so that they are effectively they're a working example, because all the other examples, and you can describe something, oh yes, we want to sound, well, everybody wants to sound approachable yet professional, don't they? That's what they all want. But you can describe that, but actually enable people to kind of assimilate it while they're reading. I think that's pretty important as well.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that. And beyond the voice and tone guide itself being an example of the voice, for me, the most useful thing is actual examples of good and bad ways to write in the brand's voice, because you can say, oh, our brand writes in a professional, approachable, friendly way. But what that means to me might mean something completely different to someone else. And so if you can actually give examples of, okay, this is the right way to write for our brand, this is the wrong way to write for our brand, then you can immediately kind of get your head into what you said, David. You can kind of absorb that. You can read the good examples, absorb that tone of voice, and then you find yourself, read enough of that and you find yourself writing in that voice almost automatically.
Yeah, it's sometimes really, with the right and the wrong way, or the old and the new way, if those examples are, I try to pick up things that the brand has really put out there, real tweets, social media posts or blog posts or titles or web pages, let's get some real world copy and kind of say, well, in future we might actually do it like this instead, to say the same thing, put it this way. And the reason that we've changed it is for these reasons. And so enable people that aren't writers to understand, okay, we've gone into the active voice, or we've used a contraction here to make it sound friendlier. Here, just a little bit of what you've done and why you've done it, so people can get a feel from it, but with stuff that they actually know, so that you can actually get a sense of moving from one thing to the other.
Out of interest, voice and sort of tone guides, and say you've got a company blog, but you want your staff to at least maintain a degree of their own voice, like how would you get around that in guidelines for writers?
Yeah, well, I think if you've got a company blog, but you've got different people writing for it, and those people are byline, so they're named, and you want some of that person's personality to come through. You don't want everybody to sound like a kind of bot, do you? Corporate copy bot. And so that's probably more where the style guide comes in rather than the voice and tone guide. So, as long as they're kind of maintaining consistency in the terminology that we use and the way we talk about things, I think it's fine for their own personality and to come out in the blog posts. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there might be things stylistically, certain words that you might want to use or not use, or you might want to keep an eye on paragraph length and making things easy to read. But absolutely, it's something where the more personality you got, kind of the more authentic it feels. While everyone still understands that they're still representing the brand, but they don't have to speak with the voice of God.
No, because that would be weird. But I think this is where messaging more comes into play, because you kind of want people to stay on message, don't you? You want them to be saying the right things about your business and what it does. So that's more, you'd expect them to kind of know our messages more than kind of write in our corporate tone of voice, if you like.
That's absolutely fair. I want to point out that nobody quite sounds the same on our blog. Nowadays, sort of stylistically, we're coming together, but Kieran's blog posts sound very different to, say, George's blog posts.
Yeah, and I think that's fine. I think that's absolutely great. Fine, yeah.
I love that. It's like, Katie did one the other day about our account managers, and it was just really funny, And I it's a really nice thing about having so many writers here, that the blog has so many flavors to it. I think that's a big positive.
Does anyone have anything else to say about tone?
Yeah, with the again, it's difficult with a voice and tone guide that you don't want to be too long. And some of it comes under real world examples and context. But I think another thing that it needs to have is an appreciation of where the customer is at, where the reader is at any given time. Because the tone that's appropriate is the tone that's appropriate to the reader, given their context, given their, whatever emotions they're feeling. You know, so you've got, and some people do this in great depth. I've spoken before about the whole MailChimp voice and tone website for their writers, and that goes into, you know, every possible context you can write for. But the thing that's really nice about it is that it goes, well, this is a success message. So at this time, the reader is feeling this, this, and this, and therefore write in that way. So if it's an error message, you go, well, look, don't joke around because people are feeling frustrated at the moment. And I think something where within the context and the examples that it gives, some appreciation of the reader and what they're feeling at that time, I think is really helpful in enabling people to select an appropriate tone within the overall brand voice.
No, that makes sense. And that's good to be able to do that. Okay, well, that is all we've got time for in this episode of Good Copy, Bad Copy. In the next podcast, we will be looking at how much copywriters should be relied on to come up with content ideas, which is a hot topic around the office. If you have any questions or comments about this episode, feel free to email us via podcast@radix-communications.com. You can also tweet Radix on Twitter @radixcom. You'll find our website at radix-communications.com, where you can also sign up for a monthly email for latest copywriting tips and insights.
Send your Ulysses memes this way.